what I want to do today is to move to giving you a technique for computing curvature, which is based on Cartan structural equations. So for the bulk of the lecture, we'll be kind of just either deriving or just seeing what these are. But I'd like to finish by showing you it, how it works in action. And that'll mean that at least probably, hopefully we'll get there, at the very end of the lecture, I might be sort of whizzing through some sort of calculation. So there, I'd ask you to just kind of hang on for the ride type of thing, because my purpose in doing that is to show you how it is a very efficient way of calculating curvature, rather than having you follow every calculational step in real time. Okay, so the purpose is more about, here, look, this is the method, and it's really good, you know, it works well, sort of thing. I think where it comes into its own is when you maybe want to explore a more general class of metrics, like an arbitrary, say, spherical symmetry in arbitrary dimension, where you're not specifying the dimension. If you have a very explicit metric, I would probably just use Mathematica to find the curvature, or whatever your favorite, you know, algebraic manipulation package is. But and that's fine if it's something very specific. But if you want to sort of step back and look at maybe more general things, then this is where this method comes into its own. Or if you're stuck without a laptop somewhere and really need to know the Riemann curvature. I don't know, it's happened to me, so anyway. Okay, so that's the general definition of a connection. But in GR, we use a metric connection. And then in conventional GR, and that's really what I'm doing here, we say that it's torsion-free. Now, the general metric connection means that grad acting on G vanishes. So there's, you know, the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. And the torsion very obvious V. So the torsion is sort of about anti-symmetry of the connection, but just be slightly wary, because if I transform this sort of geometric expression into components, the first bit gives me these two pieces give me the anti-symmetric part of the connection. But then I also have an extra piece because the basis vectors might not commute.
Wait, sorry, Ruth. Just since my memory's a little foggy about this, do we use grad G? Is that used to derive the metric connection?
It is, in the end, these conditions will specify.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have a general connection, which is defined by its action on the basis vectors. And then if we add extra conditions to our connection, that tells us something about what the components are. So I think when I introduced the Lie derivative, I commented about what would happen if a Lie bracket didn't vanish. If the Lie bracket doesn't vanish, integral curves don't close off. If the integral curves don't close off, that means those vectors don't define a coordinate basis. But conversely, if you have a coordinate basis, then these C's vanish and your connection components are anti-symmetric. So this is a sort of generalization of what you mean by an anti-symmetric. Sorry, a symmetric connection.
One quick question about a mutation. Mm-hmm. So if they close up, it means that even for a finite parameter value, if I do the acupunctural curl like with one vector field in the second, it's the same as if I had done with the second.
And then the first.
And then the first. Mm-hmm. It's that commutation just for finite parameters. It's not only locally that.
So if that is, I mean, if that is true, I mean, I guess you could imagine some vector fields where it was not always true, I suppose. But I can't think of an example offhand, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
But if it is true, then you define your coordinates by, I think I called them S and T. You simply take the parameter of one along one curve as one coordinate, and the parameter along the other curve is the other coordinate.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, yeah.
No, I'm glad I have a geometric picture for what it means to not commute.
It was on Friday. Whether it was morning or afternoon, I think my recollection of Friday's a little foggy, so I'm not sure. So that'll be the connection that you presumably did a lot about in the first GR course, yeah.
I'm sorry, but on the torsion side of the board, the last line, how did you extract the components?
The components. So you would put in U, for example, is EB. No. You'd put U is EA and V is EB, or probably got the indices wrong, but if you put in basis vectors for U and V, say if V were EB, then this would be grad V, and then you would mop up the omega with the U index, so that would be, you know, sort of release, if you like, that free index there. So it's by choosing, you either choose specific basis vectors, or you would say, well, U is equal to UAEA. You'd pull out the scalars, and then you'd be left with that relation. Yeah. Okay, so that's just sort of finishing off the thoughts of Friday about our gravity connection. So in order to talk about this Cartan formalism, it's really about breaking down the calculation of the curvature rather than doing it directly in the components. What we do is we break down our curvature into and our connection into forms. So we say our connection is going to be a one form and our curvature is going to be a two form. So this is how we define our connection one forms. This will you'll also see called the spin connection, particularly in supergravity notation. But notice that this is the geometric form index, or not index, this is the geometric object, the one form. And the A's and B's are like labels, okay? So it's telling you which particular one form it is. Mm-hmm.
Is that an O or a theta?
Theta. Mm-hmm. So if I write the this relation, the definition of the connection components, I can see that this omega here kind of matches up with those components and gives me the connection one form. So what we're going to just prove is that the symmetric part of these connection one forms. So you could think of these as a matrix labeled by A and B, components of a matrix. But this is the sort of, it's kind of, you have to sort of split out the indices from the geometry parts. Okay. So I want to just give a short demonstration of why this is true to illustrate the fact, you know, the way that we're viewing objects, the fact that when I underline, that's the signal that I'm talking from a geometrical perspective, and I'm talking about a geometric object, but that these indices here are labels. They are not the abstract index notation representing a vector or a tensor. They're just labels, okay? So in order to demonstrate this, let me look at what D of GAB is. Well, when we introduced the covariant derivative or the connection, we said that that it had to reduce to D on scalars. So here you see that these A and B are not abstract indices. They are labeling the components of the metric in a given basis. So they're scalars. Therefore, D is the same as grad. Now I have to ask, what are these components? Well, I take the geometric object, which is the metric, and I contract it with two basis vectors, or it is a rank 2 covariant tensor, therefore it's a linear map from TP of M cross TP of M into the reals. And so G acts on pairs of vectors. Now, I use that second property of the covariant derivative, which is that it's Leibnizian. So grad acting on G vanishes, so I only need to worry what happens when grad hits the basis vectors. So I do the Leibnizian thing, pull that grad in, act on everything in turn. But then this here, grad EA, this is just equal to the, well, either the gammas or the one forms tensored with EC. So here, I'm pulling out just for the, you know, when this grad sort of has also a covariant index. So here, I'm just focusing on what the metric is acting on, which is the basis vector. And then, of course, I've got essentially, actually, I shouldn't say that because we're trying to prove it's symmetric, aren't we? So that covariant derivative acting on the basis vectors gives me the connection components. They're just scalars, so I can pull them out of this bracket. So this one is just theta CA, and I'm left with G of EC EB. And this one is theta CB G AC. I think I've done, sorry, A. Oh, no, that's exactly what I wanted. There we go. Had a moment.
Sorry, can you say one more time how you got from the exterior derivative to the gradient?
So when we defined the covariant derivative on, well, one of the Fridays, it was defined as this, as a sort of derivation, which means it's Leibnizian. And it was, again, there was the sort of three conditions, but the third of which was that it reduced to D on scalars. So it's, you know, this grad, right? Whenever you take a derivative, when it acts on functions, it sort of always ends up just being the gradient.
So since we're looking at with index notation,
it's not abstract index notation. So GAB is just a set of scalars.
Oh, okay.
It's the components of the metric
okay.
in a given basis, which is what this actually means inside that bracket. This is the geometric metric, yeah. And this is some basis which I'm being quite agnostic about. Could be coordinate, could be orthonormal, might be something else. And so this is the components of the metric in that basis.
Okay.
I think the reason this gets confusing, if you become used to sort of the normal way in which we practice general relativity, the normal way in which we practice it is abstract index notation. So we sort of we see this and we think, well, that's the metric, right?
Yeah.
But in fact, it's really, you know, very strictly speaking, it's the components of the metric in a particular basis. Okay. And I think that's why Penrose was trying to be so specific about what we do when we write G mu nu. Yes?
Sorry, quick question. Could you clarify again what you mean by the B on the spin connection is just a label?
So what I mean is they're just, it's just telling you which of the connection one forms you are referring to. So what we'll see is that, say, in two dimensions, you know, say we have the two sphere, we coordinatize it in the obvious way, theta and phi. Then when we derive the spin connection, we could have a theta-theta component, potentially a theta-phi component, phi theta and phi phi. And those are all one forms. Each of those four individual things are one forms. And the you know, the values of A and B are just telling you which particular one form you're referring to, in the same way that my basis is EA, and the value of A tells me which basis vector I'm talking about. The difference here is we've got two labels, and what we'll see is that what I just said, not all of those are actually non-zero. So that's what we're going to see.
And sorry, just to follow up, sorry, this is my fault for being late, but when you say these vanish in a coordinate basis, do you mean the
structure constants, yeah.
Basis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. No, we've got...
Connected to her question about the labels and the final lines of the proof, what does it mean to multiply GCB with theta CA, for example?
So in that case, those components of the metric are sort of raising and lowering that label. So again, this is a sort of, it's kind of like the operation, you know, you're multiplying two matrices together. It's just that the values of one of the elements of the matrix happen to be one forms. But that is still a contraction. And it'll sort of become obvious in a moment, but what we're doing is we're kind of saying that we have our basis for the vectors for the manifold, the EA, but then we have the tangent, the basis of the tangent space of the manifold, the EAs. But within those EAs, we can, if we have a metric, we can relate our vector basis, you know, the sort of upstairs indices to downstairs. It's just a matrix multiplication. So I think it becomes more clear when we take an orthonormal basis, because then we're saying, so think there of the of polars in R cubed, standard Euclidean Cartesian geometry. So there we could, we usually actually, when we first do this, we usually have an orthonormal basis for our polars. So we have an ER, which is sort of essentially in our language, if it's a vector basis, it's d by dr. But rather than the coordinate basis in that case would be d by d theta. But we usually write 1 over r d by d theta. So that when we write grad, div, and curl in a sort of curvilinear coordinate system, our grad, div, and curl pick up all these extra pieces. But we could also do standard Euclidean geometry in coordinate bases. So actually, if this flipping between orthonormal and coordinate bases is confusing, my recommendation would be go back to R cubed and spherical polars and look at what the standard way of doing it is, which is an orthonormal basis, because in an orthonormal basis, the form, you don't sort of see the difference between the forms and the co-vector and vector basis. But try doing it in a coordinate basis instead. And then you start to see kind of, you know, what's going on. So there, your orthonormal basis, you know, if I think d by dr going out, d by d theta going round, say on the plane, my orthonormal basis, if I go radially outwards, it doesn't change. Yeah? It's just the same vectors being parallelly propagated. If I take the coordinate basis, on the other hand, which is just d by d theta, then as I go out, my d by d theta is getting sort of relatively sort of smaller and smaller, the length of it. No. Yes, d by d theta. So you see how we can easily get confused. So in that sense, the length of the angular either vector basis vector or basis covector changes as you move radially outwards. So that's kind of one way, you know, I think that's quite a useful exercise to do to sort of help figure out the, you know, the difference between this orthonormal basis and the coordinate one. The reason why we're fans of the orthonormal basis, and in particular people doing supergravity are fans of the orthonormal basis, is due to a theorem by Garoche, where you can only really put a spin structure on your space if there is an orthonormal, it's possible to give it an orthonormal basis globally. And so essentially what you then do is you're taking your gamma matrices, which have their anti-commutation relations telling you about the eta AB, it gives you a way of sort of painting on the gamma matrices sort of over on the manifold. So having an orthonormal basis gives you this link between your spinners and your sort of normal commuting space-time. Yep.
To follow up on this, because I've heard people talk about how if you want a spin structure, you need to have torsion. Is this...
Need to have what, sorry?
As in...
Oh. Torsion?
Yeah.
No.
I could be getting this wrong. So this isn't...
No, you don't need to have torsion. No. I mean, you can put a spin structure on as long as you've got an orthonormal basis. Mm. Yeah.
Doing a small follow-up question on the labels. Is it also related, the fact that we call them labels and not, is it also related to the transformation properties, the fact that under coordinate transformations they won't transform as tensors? Or I think they might not?
I guess I wouldn't even think to transform. So we don't have coordinate. This is with respect to a given basis, right? So if you change basis vectors, these will change, yeah? Because, you know, a change of basis, you know, your EA goes to sort of E prime B or whatever, and that's going to be some lambda BA EA, yeah? And then that will change those labels.
Mm. Yeah, sure. Like we're allowed... Yeah, I think it's worth empathizing. I think you're doing two separate transformations, right? We can change the bases independent of the underlying chart change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if we change chart, we're doing two changes at the same time, both the bases and the chart. Well, we're allowing ourselves to do a change of bases alone, I think.
If we change the chart, we wouldn't necessarily change these. In fact, we don't change these. It's quite separate. If we change the chart, we just change what our EAs are with respect to that chart. Because remember, our EA is equal to some EA mu d by dx mu, right? Yep. And this is the coordinate basis vector. You change the chart, you change this, so you change the components of E, but you don't necessarily change the geometric E.
Okay.
So you have to kind of split the two off, yeah? So I do enjoy the questions, but I'm also mindful I need to get through stuff. Last one.
Sorry,
and then you're going to give me 5 minutes. I'm interrupted.
Yeah, I'm kind of confused on your notation there, because you said spin connection is you're just writing the components, but your spin connection is equal to the connection, which is the components of the connection, and omega c, where omega c is the basis covector.
That's right, yeah.
So the right-hand side is the basis covector, and the left-hand side is just components.
No, it's one form. It is a geometric one form, because of, so I underlined it. Because you're mopping up one of these indices here, one of these labels, yeah? This here is being mopped up by that there.
Okay, so it's not components, okay.
No, the A and the B are labels, but the theta is a one form. I think it's better if I go on, because as you, it's one of these things where you've got to kind of hold a bit, because the more you see, the more things might slot into place. So an orthonormal basis, has these components here. You choose the basis such that the metric acting on two basis elements gives you the exact eta. So here, you know, plus one, minus one, minus one, minus one, the diagonal matrix. In space-time, if you were in Cartesian Euclidean geometry or Cartesian geometry, then it would be plus one, plus one, plus one. Okay. So I want to now just derive Cartan's first structural equation. So you'll see this this sort of thing cropping up. I'm going to define a two form. I defined the torsion actually originally completely without reference to a basis. I defined it via its action as a linear map, but then I wrote down what the components were. So then you kind of go part of the way back to the geometric object by mopping up the two lower covariant components. So that's the torsion two form, but now I want to do a little bit of manipulation. I'm going to replace with its actual values of the TABC, so that's gamma ABC minus gamma ACB minus the structure constants. But now, here, omega B wedge omega C is anti-symmetric as a two form. So the BC minus CB, they give me the same thing once you've contracted with omega B wedge omega C. So this is just gamma ABC omega B wedge omega C. And then I write what my structure constants are. But then here you see that this, the omega B here, gives me theta AC wedge omega C. That's the first piece. And now I want to work on this second piece. So if you remember, I wrote down an identity of the between the sort of Lie derivative and the exterior derivative. And now I'm going to just insert the insert the basis vectors. So you'll have to just refer back to that identity. So I think I gave it in general for you, a general UV and omega. But here, this is the dual basis. So this object here is delta AC, which is just either one or zero, so that vanishes. This is delta AB, again, either one or zero, so that vanishes. And so you see that omega, this quantity here, omega A, EB, EC, is minus d omega A. So this is plus 1/2 d omega A contracted with EB, EC, omega B cross omega C. But this here this kind of takes me to the components of the two form, d omega a, and then taking, you know, taking the contraction of that with the basis for two forms, essentially this thing is just equal to d omega a. Hang on, my 5 minutes is up. All right, yeah.
Sorry, I think last class or before you gave us this identity, but I don't really, I have no idea why it's true.
Okay, then it's an exercise to the reader. So you'll have to just sort of, some of these you're just going to have to sort of have a play with yourself. So, okay. I mean, a lot of it is coming also from the anti-symmetry.
I'm sorry. What do you mean by vanishes on the deltas? What if A is equal to C or something?
Yeah, it's just one or zero. It's a constant. And you're acting on it. This is the vectors, the linear map from functions to the reals. So if your function is a constant or a set of constants, you get zero. It's not that what's inside the brackets is zero. It's the fact that you are acting on it with a vector. Yeah, I probably didn't make that explicit. Thanks for raising that. So just to pull out what I've just shown is that the torsion is equal to the exterior derivative of the basis one forms plus the spin connection crossed with the basis. And that is Cartan's first structural equation. So for gravity, we set the torsion to vanish. We have a metric connection. So if we choose an orthonormal basis, which tells us that our spin connection is anti-symmetric, that's actually a huge amount of information. So so what it effectively does is it really reduces down the amount of algebraic manipulation that we have to do to calculate the connection. Moreover, D acts very intuitively. And so in the end, all the differentiation that we do tends to be quite straightforward. So I just want to present, or say very briefly, what Cartan's second equation is and how it relates to curvature. I won't prove it, but what I wanted to do was to demonstrate how this works. So just to remind you, sorry?
Why theta A be symmetric again?
Because if you have the metric connection satisfies the symmetric part of the spin connection is the exterior derivative of G. If G is orthonormal, sorry, if you've chosen an orthonormal basis, G is just eta, and those are constants. So D of them vanishes. So again, you've probably seen this, so I'm not going to. So you see this Lie bracket all over the place. So this is a linear map from three copies of the tangent space into the tangent space. And so it's a commutator of derivatives, but in order to make it sort of completely closed, you have to take that extra covariant derivative with respect to the Lie bracket. And in components, just in case you only saw it written down for coordinate basis, those are the components of Riemann. So notice that in a general basis, you get those structure constants cropping up again. And then, rather like with Cartan's first equation, we define a two-form, a curvature two-form. So again, we have the geometric Riemann. We have its components with respect to a specific basis. So we go from fully geometric to fully components. And then we sort of seem to step halfway back, a bit like we did with the torsion, and we mop up the anti-symmetric part of Riemann with our basis forms, so with a basis of the two-form space. So Cartan's second equation relates this curvature two form to the spin connection. So it's sometimes useful to recall gauge theory here. And, you know, in a sense, the connection is kind of analogous, if you like, to the gauge field. And in gauge theory, your field strength is the curvature, if you like, of that gauge. So it's equal to D of your gauge field plus the commutator of the gauge field. So electromagnetism, the Maxwell field strength is just dA, but if you have a non-abelian gauge theory, then the field strength of that is dA plus A wedge A. Yeah.
I thought that this is clearly the definition of Riemann curvature.
What, the curvature two form, or?
Like, I cannot understand why it's like a Cartan second equation. I thought it's just...
That's not the definition of curvature is actually that linear map at the top there, yeah. Yeah, and the reason you have to slot in the Lie bracket is because you define curvature via sort of shifts in vectors that are being parallelly transported around closed loops. And so to make a closed loop out of general vector fields, you have to add that little gap, if there is one, which is the Lie bracket of the two vectors. So that's why that goes in. But that, it you know, curvature really is sort of this notion that you parallel transport around a curve and you don't get back to where you start. That's the smoking gun of curvature. And that's what this top line is actually telling you.
Sorry, did you say that theta AC has to be antisymmetric if TA is zero because...
No, it has to be antisymmetric in an orthonormal basis.
Yeah,
so in GR, T is zero, G is metric, we choose an orthonormal basis so that, so theta is antisymmetric.
Because that, you're saying that because d omega A, the exterior derivative has, gives you a component that is antisymmetric.
This bit here. If G is orthonormal, if you've chosen an orthonormal basis, the components of G are either plus or minus one or zero, but they're constant. So D of those components vanishes, so theta's antisymmetric.
Ah.
Right.
Okay.
There's a lot of different bits coming together here. I'm just going to give you first a very simple example. So this is the two-sphere, the unit two-sphere. So my first step is to identify an orthonormal basis. So I choose this as my basis of one forms, and you can see that essentially I've just got the Kronecker delta being my components of the metric. Okay, now I use Cartan 1. D omega theta is 0. D omega phi is cos theta wedge d phi, which is cot theta minus cot theta omega phi wedge omega theta. So from this, that should be equal to minus theta phi theta omega theta. So that tells me I have only one non-zero connection component, which is cot theta omega phi, which is just cos theta d phi. So that's my connection. Can I just finish the computation? And then I use Cartan 2. And in this case, because I've only got one non-zero theta, the theta wedge theta part is going to vanish because I've only got one of them. And so here, this is d of minus, sorry, of cos theta d phi, which is minus sine theta wedge d phi, which is minus omega theta wedge omega phi. So I've now finished, actually, my computation of the curvature, because I can just read off. The non-zero element of the Riemann tensor. And the only thing I want to emphasize here is at this last step, I put hats on because I'm still in an orthonormal basis. So if I go through and, for example, take a sphere of radius A, so that I would put in an A squared there, then I would add A here, I would add A there. I would have an A here, I would have one over A there, and this is a one over, no, that's true. And then I would have to sort of divide that line by A. And then here, I guess this would be divided by A. That's N divided by A. And that goes divided by A squared. So I get 1 over A squared. Okay. So really, the only what you what you then have to do is to unravel that back into a coordinate basis. And so in this case, my my thetas are, my emu a for theta is just one when both of the labels have the theta value, but it's equal to, you get the sort of the a's, if you like, the radius coming in. And so my r is equal to one on a squared times delta mu lambda delta mu sigma minus delta mu sigma delta mu lambda. So that's the, that is the general expression for the curvature of a constant curvature space. Now, quickly.
Okay. Sorry. So this doesn't have to do with the whole computation. What I really want to know is, so this depends on us having an orthonormal basis, right?
The part where I'm, it's not obvious in this one, to be honest. It'll be more obvious when things, you know, you deal with a more complex example. But where it becomes important is in deciding how far you have to go. Here, I know I'm finished because the fact that I have an orthonormal basis, I've only got this. This is a 2x2. The spin connection is a 2x2 matrix of forms. Because it's anti-symmetric, I only have one independent component. That's the off-diagonal one. So once I've computed this, I know I need go no further because every, you know, the diagonal terms are zero and the off diagonal terms are just related by a minus sign. So that is where I, in this case, that's where I used the fact it was an orthonormal basis.
Okay, but the getting an orthonormal basis, is it always, like if you have a basis that's not orthonormal, then do you have to just, you know, guess coordinate transformations to change it, or is there a systematic way to do it, maybe using?
I think that would be called, but guess is perhaps slightly unfair as a word, but it is more or less, yes, you do it by inspection. So with many metrics you meet, it's actually really obvious, right? Where it becomes less obvious is where there are things like cross terms. So for example, the Kerr metric, there's several ways in which you can choose an orthonormal basis for that. I mean, there's three obvious ones that I'm thinking of, you know, so if you have cross terms, you can choose to complete a square, you know, in the metric in more than one way, typically. Okay. But quite often, a lot of very useful metrics are already block diagonal, and once they're block diagonal, it's obvious, right? Okay. It's only when they're not block diagonal that you maybe have a little bit of choice.
Okay.
And then some metrics are severely off, you know, non-diagonal. So in which case, yeah, I mean, and it does get more challenging.
Your R5 theta, I think, should have 1 over a cubed.
No, because it's a curvature.
I mean, yeah. No, the calculation, I mean, because you had, in the second to last one, you had sine theta, theta wedge d phi over
mm-hmm.
a,
mm-hmm.
So you replace d theta and d phi with omegas. And each
all right, so you're saying that actually at this point, so yeah, I probably tried to do this too quickly. So that's definitely that there, that's definitely one on a. So that should be right. That should be right. Yeah, I see what you mean. I've been too quick, because it's definitely not a 1 and a cubed. Okay, where I've done it. Just a minute. So that has an A in it. That's there. That is 1 over A there. So then this is 1 over A. That doesn't have a 1 over A in it because there's an A in the d omega phi. So this is no 1 over A, no 1 over A there. That's it. No, that's it. Right now. Correct now. Okay. Not going to get the next bit done.
To write the covector pieces omega a, sorry, omega theta and omega phi. I'm assuming the orthonormal basis, for example, in the direction of phi, is given by 1 over sine theta d by d theta, 1 over sine theta d by d phi.
If it was the vector basis, yes. Mm-hmm.
In this particular calculation, because you're saying that omega phi is the
covector basis the element. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It necessarily has to be that E phi is 1 over sine theta d by d phi.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yep.
When we are in the orthonormal basis, that commutator of EBEC would be 0 in the definition of CABC, right? So it's CABC.
Sorry, the.
Like when we know that in we have a normal basis, we have the commutator of EBEC equal to 0. Right?
No. Not at all, not necessarily, no. The orthonormal basis is where the metric, the fact that when you take the metric components are equal to eta ab. So your vector, if you like, if you go back to normal Cartesians, your vector either, it has unit length and it is orthogonal to the other basis vectors. That's what orthonormal means. No. But you can see it isn't, precisely from what was just said. Here you've got E theta is d by d theta, E phi is d 1 over sine theta, d by d phi. So E theta, E phi, which is basically E theta, E phi, minus E phi, E theta. That's when you hit this with a d by d theta, you're going to get minus cos theta over sine squared theta d phi, d by d phi. Yep.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking this is because, you know, when we're defining the Riemannian curvature, I usually say that the end part, like the last part of CACD.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, like, what is the condition in order to have that? Probably, you know, whenever we have the commutator of EBEC is equal to...
Sorry, could you... Because I can't quite hear. Yeah.
You know, I was wondering, because, you know, whenever I saw, like, the Riemannian curvature, I didn't see, like, the last part, which is, like, a CABC.
Well, that's because normally when you meet it, you're working in coordinate bases. Almost all the time we do calculations in GR, we do them in a coordinate basis. So we never see the structure constants. So, but if you want to have a general basis, you have to put those in. Because even this is just standard. Yeah. You know, this will happen in Cartesians. There are non-zero commutators. So, yeah. So.
Can you explain again how the last step happened? Like, how did that reduce to the... Yeah, how did the second last thing go?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, in this is kind of jumping a bit and, you know, just simply due to time pressure. It's really just saying that the only non-zero component is when you've got these two being different and these two being different. And so you just kind of look and you say, well, it's going to be either plus or minus. So I have... just look to say here, you know, this is plus when the first and the third are the same and the second and the fourth are the same. So here, this picks that out, first and third the same, second and fourth the same. But then conversely, you know that Riemann has all these various symmetries. You know it's anti-symmetric on this pair of indices. So that's why I've swapped the indices here. But the reason I wrote it like this is because this result is more generally applicable to constant curvature spaces. So I just wanted to put that out there so that it, you know, you've seen it, if you like.
So it's not directly derivable from this?
Oh, it will. If you look at it, you'll see that, yes, that is what it, you know, what it does. The fact that this, you know, I've picked off this explicit form of what the Riemann components are, but then I know, you know, I can step back and deduce other anti-symmetries of the Riemann tensor based on properties of the spin connection. So I'll end up seeing that it's anti-symmetric on the first two indices. If you pull them all downstairs, you know, I know it's anti-symmetric on the first two. And so in essence, I'm just writing down the simplest thing that has all of those relations. So I wouldn't say that, oh, it should be obvious, but it's one of those things where a moment's thought and a little bit of playing around on a piece of paper, you'll see it. So I have to stop, I'm sorry, because I have something I've got to get to. But so next time on Wednesday, we'll kind of pick up this thought and we'll look at black holes.